Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
As temperatures rise around the globe, workers are often left feeling the heat.
Heat illnesses are very real and dangerous on construction sites any time of year. And we must always include heat protections to keep our workers safe.
We'll look into the lack of federal protections for working in extreme heat. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway for August 26th. Wow, August 26th. But our lead story on the podcast, NFL quarterback Andrew Luck is retiring at just 29 due to health concerns. Sports journalist Buzz Bissinger and former NFL player Joshua Perry weigh in on Luck's decision to leave the league.
I'm sure that affects your mental attitude. What is the injury? Am I going to be in rehab again? What is wrong with me? And it's got to play on your psyche.
Injury is always one of the hardest parts of the game because you enjoy being out there. You enjoy supporting your teammates. But when you can't get back on a specific timeline and you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, oftentimes it becomes more of a mental grind than anything else.
And that's where we start. Let's get going. Over the weekend in the NFL, Indianapolis Colts quarterback Andrew Luck made a surprising announcement.
It certainly isn't how I envisioned this or planned this, but I am going to retire. This is not an easy decision. Honestly, it's the hardest decision of my life.
Luck said an unrelenting cycle of injuries and rehab was behind his move to step away from the game at the age of 29. But as he left the Colts stadium during a preseason game on Saturday, some fans were less than appreciative of their star player. Luck isn't the first professional football player to leave the sport in his prime, but he is one of the most high-profile in recent memory. And his decision comes amid growing concerns about the long-term consequences of playing football. Luck's departure has also put a spotlight on how the NFL recruits and retains its top players. I'm joined by award-winning journalist and author of Friday Night Lights, Buzz Bissinger. And also joining us is Joshua Perry, a former NFL linebacker who played with the San Diego Chargers and the Indianapolis Colts before retiring in 2018 at the age of 24. Buzz, Joshua, welcome to The Takeaway.
Glad to be here.
Buzz, let's start with you. What was your immediate reaction when you heard Andrew Luck was retiring?
Well, I know everyone thinks that the sky is falling, but you know the guy has had an incredible series of injuries in the 6 years that he's played, including a lacerated kidney, a partially torn abdomen, torn cartilage in his ribs, torn labrum, and now he has this latest calf and ankle injury. He's beat up. He's been in constant rehab. He was urinating blood, and I think he said, enough's enough. I'm not enjoying the game. I'm scared of getting hurt again. I don't want to have to rehab. He did miss a year, and he had the sanity to say, that's it. I'm done. Now, does it foreshadow what's going to happen with other athletes? I don't know, but I commend him because many players play way too long. We can find isolated examples of those who did not, like Barry Sanders or Calvin Johnson, but Luck said, I'm done. And, you know, I think it's great that he knew it then and knows it now and will move on with his life. Of course, there is the chance that, you know, he may come back. People retire and then miss the game so much that they do come back.
Joshua, you played with the Colts, Andrew Luck's team, during your time in the NFL, and we're going to get into that in a little bit. But I'm wondering, how aware were you of Luck's struggles with his injuries?
I think the big thing was you could see the struggle with his rehab. I was there in 2017. That was the year he was out with the shoulder injury. And I think just staying engaged with the game is hard for anybody who's hurt. And now, he was always a great teammate, and he was somebody who was supportive. But you could see his want to get out on the field. You could see how he wanted his shoulder to, you know, get better. And there was a time where they thought he was on track, and then he ended up going overseas to Europe for treatment because he wasn't coming along as quickly as he wanted to. And I think that's kind of the hard thing with every athlete. You know, injury is always one of the hardest parts of the game because you enjoy being out there, you enjoy supporting your teammates. But when you can't get back on a specific timeline and you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, oftentimes it becomes more of a mental grind than anything else. And so I think in his retirement, that was one of the things that he spoke about. And that was one of the things that I could definitely agree with.
And Joshua, let's talk about that a little bit, because you and others have stepped away from football early in your career. You talked just about the mental anguish, but what was your experience like being in the league? I mean, did you feel that you had a choice, or were you also dealing with a lot of rehab and injuries?
Well, Tanzina, that's a really good question. I think for me, the biggest thing that I dealt with was the concussion aspect. And, you know, I was even having a conversation with a close friend and my girlfriend last night, and I was telling them that that last year, if I could have had an ACL tear, I would have absolutely wanted that to happen over another concussion, because I knew I could rehab and come back through that. But the brain health question is something that's really strong. It's something that you have to really evaluate to see when enough is enough. For me, injuries piled up, but being a linebacker, you get back out there and you play the game. I think the hardest part is understanding how you're going to walk away and then what you're going to do after. And I'm thankful that I had, you know, great family background. My mom and dad are great earners on their own, so I'm not supporting them. You know, I've got two brothers who are very supportive and a girlfriend who I love who supported me as well. And it made it easy to step out of the game. There are other guys, they have families they got to worry about. They got to send money home, etc. And it's not so easy for them. And then the other thing, I graduated from Ohio State in 3.5 years, where a lot of guys enter the league, barely graduated or haven't graduated from school yet. And then they wonder what they're going to do when they step away from the game. So I think part of it is you're gripped by the financial aspect. Is, you know, you make so much money in one point and you're trying to capitalize off of that. You're trying to make sure you maximize that, where a lot of times your health becomes secondary. And then you don't really feel it until it's too late. I think that's part of it, too, is having the ability to see beyond, having the ability to understand that it's more of a long-term deal.
Buzz, I'd love to get your thoughts on what Joshua just said. I mean, in terms of a player's status, but also, you know, generally that status is also tied to what they get paid. Is it easier for higher paid players like Andrew Luck to retire early than someone who doesn't have a multi-million dollar contract and who might be supporting their family perhaps for the first time?
Well, you know, I suppose it's easier for Andrew Luck in the sense that he has a great cushion, but he's also leaving a lot of money on the table. I don't think money entered into the issue, as Joshua points out. Look, the average life of an NFL player is 3 years. You get $500,000. I think that's the starting salary as a rookie without bonus. It's not a very long shelf life. Joshua was smart because he went to school. He graduated in 3.5 years. I mean, let's face it. A lot of these guys, you know, college is the minor league system. And I get that. I mean, they're going to colleges to play football. They're not going to colleges to study, and they should be paid. But Andrew just said enough. I mean, you know, the fans booing him was disgusting. It's his body. It's his mental attitude. He owes the fans the ability to play his heart out when he wants to play. He does not owe the fans the ability to ruin his body and his mental health playing a game that, as he says, no longer has the magic. So how good would he be? And football is a really, really, really violent game. I like it because it's violent. People like it because it's violent. They don't like to admit to that because it's not politically correct. But if you watched Andrew Luck, he was getting bashed and battered, particularly, I think, 2015-16. There was a lousy offensive line. Every play, he was getting creamed. And he's big, and he's aggressive, and enough's enough. You know, what else do you need?
Joshua, I want to pick up on that with you, because we heard at the top the fans booing Luck on the field after they learned he was retiring. There was a lot of chatter on social media about his retirement, and it was early. Were you surprised by the backlash from some of the fans? And being someone who's been on the field and played this sport in the NFL, what is it that the fans aren't understanding about the experiences of players like you and Luck?
I'm not surprised, and that's not to disparage any fans. I think it was egregious that they booed, but I just don't think that they could understand it from a level that a player does. The fans are so much in a "what have you done for me lately" mentality, and Luck did a great job last year. They were expecting him to come back and do it again, and they hadn't seen him all preseason. And I feel like there was a lot of frustration based off of the timing, but at the same time, who wouldn't be frustrated? Andrew Luck was frustrated that he had to cut his career short too. It's so strange. I think fans oftentimes need to take a step back to understand, by 29 years old, for a lot of these guys, you've been playing football for, you know, probably 20 years.
Well, and you've been probably fans don't care about the mental and physical health of athletes. athletes.
It's a shame.
That they don't care. They live in a bubble. If someone retires because of concussions, they don't say to themselves, "Oh my God, what is the future going to be like?" They're saying, "Well, he's gone. Who's going to fill the shoes?" So I don't think many fans really could give a flying crap about what Andrew Luck has been for. Fans are now worrying, who's going to come in? Is it going to be Jacoby Brissett? Are they going to get Eli Manning? Blah, 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 blah. Fans live in a bubble. They don't understand it on the field level. And, you know, he had another injury. I'm sure that affects your mental attitude. What is the injury? Am I going to be in rehab again? What is wrong with me? And it's got to play on your psyche.
As I said, that's one of the hardest things. I mean, think about it. Your teammates are wondering why you're not out there. Fans are looking at you all kinds of crazy. And then for a guy that's had that many injuries, you're literally questioning, can my body actually stand up to the test of this game? And that's one of the hardest places to be in, because if you're questioning if your body can stand up, if you're questioning if you're built to play the game, you're going to struggle to actually get back out there and play the game at a high level. And that's a place where I've been mentally before. And like you said, people don't care. We are seen as entertainment. You know, we are seen as on-demand Sundays. I turn the TV on. You guys do what you're supposed to do. Entertain me. But there is a mental side of it that is dark. And we don't even really talk about it in locker rooms, let alone fans talking about it. But that is one of the biggest aspects of the game that I think needs to have a shift, and just a whole paradigm shift, is the mental anguish and then being able to talk about it where people don't look at you like you're soft.
I want to bring it back to a second because, Joshua, you mentioned earlier in the conversation that you had concussions, and that was one of your biggest concerns. We know that there have been lots of concerns about brain damage that have deterred many parents even from allowing their kids to play football at early ages. But a lot of folks who still play the sport and who are being encouraged to play the sport are increasingly low-income Black and brown students. For them, I'm wondering, do the opportunities outweigh the costs, Joshua?
We emphasize in society and culture the wrong things for the wrong people. And it was easy for me to play football the way that I did. I came from a very middle-class upbringing. I always knew that I was going to be academics first. You know, Stanford was my second choice after the Ohio State University. And the only reason Ohio State was my number one choice is it was 30 minutes from where I grew up from. A lot of these kids get a dream, and their parents get a dream that, hey, make $1 million playing in the league. Well, first and foremost, $1 million ain't that much money when you really boil it down. But second off, it's not long money either. It's not something that you can sustain for a ton of years. And so I think there needs to be a little bit of a shift. But I also appreciate kids being in team sports and learning some of the lessons that you learn playing a tough, rugged sport like football. It pains me every time I hear a family talking about, you know, their middle or high school son is playing football and he's really good and he's going to be the next Ezekiel Elliott. He's going to be the next, you know, Phillip Rivers, whatever it is. And it's like, the odds are so slim. We need to prioritize what's important, and we need to also care for our bodies and our minds.
Buzz, what impact is this going to have, you think, on the NFL's drafting process or any process? I mean, are they going to start to take injuries more seriously, concussions more seriously? No, you don't say.
No, because it's a multi-billion dollar machine. It is huge money. It's not going to affect how they draft. I mean, this comes completely out of the blue. This is a singular case involving a very, very good quarterback. The problem with the NFL, I think, is that at a certain point, there's a tipping point where they dilute the game so much that it no longer has the visceral, physical violence that people want. That's what they face. They're continually trying to tinker with it and handle concussions. And by the way, you know, what happened to Andrew Luck has only happened in football for like a zillion years. You know, if you want to know what it's like to play football, go see Earl Campbell. You remember Earl Campbell? The great Tyler Rose, running back for the Houston Oilers, 250-pound, just a monster. Well, he walks with two canes because he can't walk anymore because of knees. Fans don't care about that. They only think about Earl Campbell when he was on the field. They only think about Joshua Perry when he's on the field. We sell a bill of goods. We've only been doing this for about 50 years to minority communities. This is the ticket out. I mean, look at sports pages. Where do you see minorities routinely praised as role models? On the sports page. Parents get this dream, my son is going to be this, he's going to be that, and they do not know that you have much better chances of becoming a lawyer, a doctor, an accountant than a football player or a basketball player. But as it was shown in Friday Night Lights, you know, you're extolled, you're treated special since literally now the age of 7, and then it ends. You remember Bo Jackson? When he got hurt, it's Bo who? It ends and you're done. And we talk endlessly about changing the paradigm and wanting these guys to concentrate on education. Well, I don't know how you can concentrate on education when you're practicing 2 hours a day, and that's just practice, game tapes, game plans, and they're there to play football. And Joshua knows better than I, but I think when you're playing Division One, I think every player, regardless of whether it's true or not, and it often isn't, they think they're going to be drafted, and they're not.
I want to jump in on that on both ends. The first end, where you talked about, does it change the drafting process? The only potential change I see, and it happened to me when I was going through the process, was they grill a guy who comes out of university with great grades, or they'll grill a guy that comes from a Stanford, a Princeton, a Northwestern, to see if they truly want to play football, to see if a couple of injuries isn't going to derail their career. And Andrew Luck's a little bit different because he made so much money as a quarterback. But again, a Stanford guy, you know, comes from a little bit of money. He didn't have to play the game. He didn't have to play the game to begin with, but at this point, he definitely didn't have to stay. But on the back end of that, I think part of the deal too, like you said, guys are getting coddled, they're getting patted on the back. But when you get into college, it becomes different because they tell you you're a student athlete. Student first, athlete second, but you schedule practice first and then you schedule classes second. And I think from the moment that a lot of these guys walk into their universities, regardless of if they become professional players, there's already a mindset shift for them where they're stuck in this mentality of becoming a professional athlete. They want to be this. And I've seen it to the point where guys, undrafted rookies, don't make a roster, and it's 3-4 years later and they're still training to try to make a roster. And it's because they're stuck on that dream. Emphasize other things. Learn what skills translate from football into the real world and be able to apply them. And we're not doing our athletes favors if we're not doing this from a young age.
Joshua Perry is a former NFL linebacker who played with the San Diego Chargers and the Indianapolis Colts. Buzz Bissinger is an award-winning journalist and author of the book Friday Night Lights. Joshua, Buzz, thank you so much for being with The Takeaway.
Hey, thank you.
The summer of 2019 is on track to be one of the hottest on record. And across the country, workers in several different industries have to endure that heat. And you told us about it.
Hi, this is Melissa. I'm calling from the New York City area. Heat illnesses are very real and dangerous on construction sites any time of year. We must always include heat protections to keep our workers safe. We ask them to dress appropriately, take breaks as required, stay hydrated, eat nourishing meals, and to stay in good physical health in general.
This is Jared calling from Plano, Texas. I've been a landscaper for about 9 years, and although this summer has not quite been as hot, I do know with rising temperatures, it really doesn't leave us with much option.
Hey, my name's Matt from St. Paul. I'm an arborist, and the heat definitely takes a toll. Not only does it affect the working crew members, but it also affects the trees, adding an additional stressor.
Between 1992 and 2017, more than 800 workers died in the United States from heat exposure, and roughly 70,000 became seriously ill. It's no surprise that the people hit hardest are those who work outside, like the construction and farming industries. We spoke with Edgar Franks, a farm worker union organizer based in Washington State, and he told us about the challenging realities of working outdoors in the summer.
There was emergency notices that were going out. You know, they were like, if you're going to be outdoors, you know, we recommend you stay indoors. But at the same time, you know, it's peak berry season. So farm workers had to be out in the fields doing the work.
Edgar says that workers are dying because of it.
At a farm here in Sumas, Washington, one of the farm workers passed away. But because of the working conditions and the amount of stress that the heat and all the conditions, we feel that that was one of the causes of his death.
The Occupational Health and Safety Administration has guidelines around extreme heat, but no set standards. That means the onus is on employers to make sure their workers are safe. Here's Chris Hoffman, the area director for OSHA's office in Parsippany, New Jersey.
OSHA doesn't have a standard for every potential hazard. So OSHA has, under Section 5A1 of the Occupational Safety and Health Act, a general duty clause that requires employers to maintain workplaces that are free of recognized hazards that can cause serious physical harm or death. And this includes protecting workers from extreme heat.
Hoffman said OSHA's guidelines are not expected to change in the immediate future, but workers are still feeling the heat, and we're going to talk about it. For more, I'm joined by Shanna Devine, a worker and health safety advocate at Public Citizen, and Adiel Kaplan, a reporter at NBC Investigations. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Shanna, let's start with you. Why aren't there any federal standards regulating hot workplace conditions?
We have that same question. This is a longstanding issue, heat in the workplace, and we have petitioned OSHA historically to protect workers against heat. It's declined to do so, claiming that it can already protect workers against heat through the general duty clause that was discussed in the opening of this program.
So if someone on the job gets sick or worse because of health-related issues, to what extent does OSHA get involved?
Very rarely. In this case, we've found unfortunately, heat-related illnesses are underreported, and also enforcement is very low at OSHA. Even though there's been a reported 815 deaths over the last several decades, that's likely to be a very low number. And due to the limited resources that OSHA has and the difficulty of enforcement under the general duty clause, this issue is not getting the attention it deserves in the workplace. Rather, OSHA will respond after a heat-related injury or fatality has already taken place rather than before, which is why we're advocating for a standard which would require preventative measures.
Adiel, I want to bring you in here because you've reported on a number of stories about heat-related injuries for UPS drivers, which was really interesting to me. How many UPS drivers that you've interviewed have suffered from heat-related injuries, and why is this happening?
Dozens of them. It's happening because UPS trucks, the delivery brown trucks that you're used to seeing in your neighborhood everywhere, they're not air-conditioned. They don't have a lot of good airflow in the back. And the temperatures in the cargo area can climb. We've had drivers send us photos of temperature readings above 150 degrees. And that's in places like Arizona. And these drivers are working, 10, even 12-hour shifts going in and out of that cargo area.
Why are these trucks not air-conditioned? I was just going to ask you, aren't the trucks air-conditioned? But why? That seems like a pretty big oversight.
That's the thing. Most of us who see these drivers, we just assume it's like our car. It's got AC, it's got heat. Well, it's not the same. These trucks have been around for decades. UPS is more than a 100-year-old company. And the company told us that they don't air condition the delivery vehicles because it'd be inefficient. The drivers are in and out of there so frequently, they're turning on and off. But drivers say that they're not necessarily asking for air conditioning specifically. They want more airflow. They want a little bit more time. The best prescription for heat risk is water, rest, and shade. And what they're telling us is that they don't have enough opportunity to take those breaks and to take care of themselves.
We just heard Shanna say that a lot of these, the data is often not reflective and it's underreported. Did you find the same with UPS drivers?
Absolutely. And I should say it's not just UPS. The Postal Service also does not have air-conditioned vehicles for most of its delivery drivers. And for FedEx, it's actually much harder to tell whether there is AC for vehicles because many vehicles are leased through contracting agencies.
What did UPS say in response to your reporting?
They said that the vast majority of their drivers know how to take care of themselves and that heat illnesses are an extremely small portion of the illnesses and injuries that they see at work and affect an extremely small number of their drivers.
So, Shanna, as temperatures are climbing across the world, are we noticing more heat-related injuries and even deaths?
We found there are. We've analyzed the data and seen that as temperatures have gone up over the last decade or so, so have heat-related fatalities. Heat is already the leading weather-related killer in the United States, and we just had in July, the hottest month ever recorded on Earth. So this problem is not going away. And even if we start to take the measures to address climate change, temperatures will need to level off before workers aren't feeling the heat as much in the workplace. So we are long overdue to address this problem, and it's only projected to get worse.
You're working on federal legislation in this area. Walk us through what you're proposing.
Thank you for raising that. We're teaming up with, and I should say Public Citizen is partnering with a broad coalition of environmental, labor, and public health groups. United Farm Workers is one of our lead partners. And we're teaming up with Congressional Champions Representative Chu from California and Representative Grijalva from Arizona to protect workers against heat through legislation that would require OSHA to issue a heat prevention standard. This is very common sense legislation. The bill number is HR 3668. The crux of this legislation is that it would require employers to issue common sense protections against heat, including access to water, rest, shade, or a cool environment for workers who are indoors, training, an acclimatization program, which means that workers must have an adjustment period as they're new workers and first exposed to the heat. Research has found that the majority of heat-related fatalities take place within the first 3 days on the job. So that's a very fundamental provision. And then importantly, it requires protections against retaliation so that the most vulnerable workforce, often immigrant workers, undocumented workers, low-wage workers, would have rights when they speak out about unsafe working conditions, including excessive heat.
Adiel, you talked to UPS delivery drivers about these rising temperatures, but they're also dealing with an increase in the work itself, aren't they? I mean, more and more people are ordering things online. I think almost every lobby in New York City that you go into is just full of packages from, you know, fill in the blank online delivery service. Have the schedules of delivery drivers and the pressures that they're under increased as well?
That's what we're hearing. The delivery economy is the economy now. And what's happened is that drivers are telling us they've never had schedules like this in the past. They're seeing July volumes that to them are the same as peak season, you know, holiday shopping time. But now they're having to deliver that amount of packages without the holiday helpers they usually get and in the middle of summer heat. And that's really taking its toll on them.
What could UPS do short of, you know, any actual regulations or standards here to make sure that their workers are protected from the heat? I mean, do you get a sense that they have any plans to do that?
I haven't heard any plans from them on this, but drivers have basically told us that all they really want is more of an opportunity to take breaks and take care of themselves. You know, they're out there day after day. Most of them take very good care of themselves. They have to, or they wouldn't last in that job. It's a very physically demanding job. You're basically lifting weights in the back of a sauna all day long, on and off. I mean, many of these packages weigh 70 pounds or even potentially more just because we're ordering so many dressers and mattresses and things like that. And it's just one guy in that truck.
Shanna, what about, you mentioned undocumented workers. I'm curious, would there be any interest, given the current political climate that we're in right now, to protect undocumented workers? A lot of those folks are construction workers or working in the fields and picking fruit that are already working under precarious conditions.
That's right. And as a worker, whether you're undocumented or not, you have the right to report a worker health and safety violation or threat. OSHA is required to protect you against these violations. Unfortunately, under the current law and legal system, the rights are very weak, which is why we are proposing that the heat prevention standard, once it's put into place, have stronger protections against retaliation. I think there's certainly an understanding amongst our congressional champions on this issue that every worker should have the right to a safe workplace, whether or not they're undocumented or not.
Shanna Devine is a work health and safety advocate at the consumer advocacy organization Public Citizen. And Adiel Kaplan is a reporter with NBC Investigations. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you on rising heat temperatures in the workplace. What impact has it had on your ability to do the job? Does your work have protections for hot weather? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.